Okay, we're back, and we're joined by Mr. Bill Neely. And Bill is going to take us on a little adventure to Japan, and he calls it the Ascending the Steps of Japanese Spiritual Culture in Nikko. Good morning, Bill.
Morning. How you doing, Roy?
We're doing terrific. This sounds like a really exciting adventure you were on here, and it seems that previously you'd gone to other countries, like a lot of us, in Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and then you just set your sights on Japan, and you decided instead of traveling in a tour or staying in the more Western-style hotels, that you were going to attempt this journey on your own. Now, tell us a bit about it.
Well, we had never been to Asia proper, so we sort of thought Japan might be our best venue to go there, but we don't speak Japanese, and we still wanted to go where we were staying, sort of in more the inns and the type of places that the Japanese might be staying, and also try to see if we could kind of make it more an econo tour, in a sense, that it would be more economical to the average tourist to go there and see what that would be like.
Well, of course, you know, this works in a lot of countries, but when you go, because most people speak English, but when you get outside the major cities and start traveling on subways and using the public transportation, it must get a little bit hairy.
Yeah, it did. The only thing that saved us was the people, the Japanese people, in the sense that they were so gracious and so kind and so helping, even without being able to speak our language, a lot of them. I mean, you could, in certain parts, of, particularly in Tokyo and Kyoto, find people who spoke English, but where we were staying in the little ryokans and off the beaten path and then getting on the subways and whatnot, you ran into a lot fewer people that spoke English, but when they saw you were in need, they sort of came to your need, and through signs or just taking you by the hand and leading you somewhere, they'd get you around.
Well, the Japanese tend to be courteous. You know, they're very courteous people.
Yeah.
So now had you previously selected hotels? You must have done some research on this.
I did research, a lot of the research I did online, and looked up different, you know, we knew which areas we wanted to go to, and we knew sort of where we wanted to go from one area to the other, you know, so many days in one place and so many days in another. But once we got to a place, like when we got to Tokyo, we spent about 4 days there. And then when we went to Kyoto, we went to Mount Fuji, we spent another 4 days there. And then we went down to Kyoto, and we spent about 5 days there. But we didn't really lay out exactly what we'd do until we got there. We knew what was there from our research, but we wanted to wait and get there and then see what hit us once we got there.
Right. Now, after you got out of Tokyo and started traveling, what was the first hotel you stayed at, a local type hotel?
Well, in Tokyo, we actually stayed in a little ryokan in the Asakusa area, which is sort of in the northern part of the city. It's one of the older parts of Tokyo, and we had a little room that was like 10 by 10 and a, you know, futon, and but it was very clean, very nice, and we were right close to subway, and it was worked out just fine.
And the facilities were good.
The facilities were good, and the people were very nice. In fact, the last day we were getting ready to get to the train, and we were wanting a taxi, and the taxi was slow coming, and the owner of the little ryokan motioned for us to get in the car with him, and he took us himself to the train station and put us on. So,
now tell us about that, the metro and the JR train systems.
Well, one thing, it's a little mind-boggling when you look at the maps of those, particularly the subways. They're all in different colors, and it looks like a multicolored spaghetti under the ground of Tokyo. If you sit and spend some time studying, which I did, the different areas you wanted to go to on the surface had a surface map with the places in English marked out,
right.
And then you could go to the station and you could, you know, somehow go from one place to the other. But once you figured it out, it was very convenient, very fast.
So it was color-coded. It was just a matter of figuring out the the system itself.
Right, and what line you wanted to go on, and then you would maybe have to change lines. But we messed around really didn't get lost much at all. I mean, you'd get a little off the track of where you wanted to go, but then you could kind of get on another subway and get back.
And you said Nikko was one of the best days that you spent in Japan.
Yeah, and the only reason we went to Nikko is we went to the tourism office there in Asakusa because it was right near a temple area, and we were asking them about places to see, and they asked if we were going to Nikko, and we said, no, we really weren't familiar with that, and they said, oh, you must go. So anyway, they talked us into it, and it's about a little over a two-hour train trip from the Asakusa station up to Nikko. And Nikko is in the mountains, and it is actually sort of a city of temples and shrines.
And the train trip was comfortable?
Oh, very comfortable. Yeah, it was. The train travel is delightful over there, and it has all kinds of amenities, and they always have plenty of food, and it's fast, and you're always getting off right downtown wherever, even in Nikko we were right at the center of town where we got off.
Now, of course, you visited a number of temples. Tell us something about that.
Well, when we arrived in Nikko, we had the day, and we left about 8 in the morning from Tokyo, and we were there a little after 10. And there are lots of shops and lots of restaurants, and there's along the main street in Nikko. But the person who's the traveler is probably going there to see the temple areas, which are pretty vast, or to see Nikko National Park, which is right out of there and up in the mountains. And the whole Nikko area, or where the temples are, is a World Heritage Site. So when we got off the train, what we did, instead of going down through the main street and browsing in the shops and whatnot, is we got a bus pass, which we could get on a bus at any time from any point where the bus stopped, and it would take us up to the temple area, and it even would take you up into the national park if you got, depending on what kind of pass you got.
And there are passes that tell us a little bit about the passes, because I always find that interesting when you go to various countries that they have these train passes and bus passes.
Yes, it was just like it was a local, the local municipal bus service. But you could get a whole day pass, and they had different rates. If you just were going to the temple area, you probably would get a less expensive pass. I can't even remember right now what it cost, but it was fairly nominal. But what we did is we got the whole day pass for the area, and therefore you could pick up any bus that was coming along and that was going to any particular place. There's botanical gardens there you could go to. Like I said, you could go up to Nikko National Park, and up there's a big lake up there in the national park. But our first and main thing was to go to the temple area, so we got our pass at the station, got on the first bus, and rode it up the hill. Now, the tourism agency said, well, you can just walk to the temple from the railroad station, but I would not recommend that unless you're going to be there a few days, because it is a pretty good climb even when you get to the temple area.
And what's also interesting is that the JR station was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in 1915.
That's right. Yes, it is. And it's very much in Frank Lloyd Wright style, which is kind of curious there in Japan.
Yeah, I would say that would have certainly surprised me. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
So, if I can just suggest to our listeners that have a computer in front of them or are listening to us on the web, I recommend that you go to our website, and there's a link there to some incredible photos that you can follow while you're listening to this. And I was very impressed. Great photos, Bill. Super photos. All right, so from there, take us on from there.
Okay, well, the first temple we went to, or the first one we came to, was called the Rinnoje Temple, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing these right, but our Rinnoje Temple, and it's sort of at the foot or the beginnings point, at least it seemed that for us. And we went through that area, that temple area. and moved from that, though, to the more impressive areas were on up the hill to what is called the Toshogu Shrine,
uh-huh.
which is a shrine that was built by a shogun back in the 1500s. And he was one that kind of started a long shogun dynasty. But this shrine goes up this sort of mountain, or up this hills that are in the mountains, and it's surrounded by a huge, what I would almost say are sequoias. And and you go from one gate to another, keep progressing up steps, up the hill, until you get to the final inner temple or inner shrine.
And you say that there are different elements like earth, water, fire, and wind.
First pagoda that you come to is a pagoda which is five-tiered, and that those tiers each represent, starting with the bottom tier is earth, and then the next is water, fire, wind, and the last is heaven.
Each of those elements, right?
Each of those elements, but they're incredibly crafted, everything there. In fact, at this shrine, the stable, the sacred stable, has carved these carvings on it, and in that are the monkeys, the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil.
Which we're all very familiar with.
Yeah,
yes.
And they're in there carved in, and you can see that, and it's sort of one of those focal points to see. But that's just the sacred stable. It's not even as elaborate as any of the other buildings, and which if you do look at some of the pictures, you can kind of see the elaborateness of the carvings and the gold and whatnot that they've put on these places.
And there's a lot of work by a lot of artists and craftsmen.
Right. And in fact, they tell us in the temples in the shrine buildings that they did not use nails. Now, I'm not sure that's absolutely correct, but I think it is that everything is sort of tongue and grooved and fitted together. And that's pretty unbelievable when you see the height and the size and, you know, the way these things are constructed.
Now, what was the final, you say you visited, the final shrine was even steeper and longer climb.
Yeah, we then moved up to, and I can't pronounce it very well, but it's Tayun Bao Shrine.
Which, I kind of skipped around that myself.
Yeah, anyway, and it is really on up the hill or mountain, and there you have lots and lots of stairs. I mean, I think Bonnie and I quit counting after we counted 800 steps going
Good
up.
Good Lord.
This is not one of the things that I would say to be careful of is it's not handicap facilities. In other words,
right.
you have a hard time maneuvering around these shrines if you were, say, like in a wheelchair or you were on crutches. And so you would, need to take that into consideration.
And you said this was finished back in 1653?
Well, yeah, they were in the 1600s.
Amazing.
When a lot of this was built.
And it was isolated for over 200 years, is that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It is sort of, when you get to this area, you find as you get into these mountains that you have almost a feeling of isolation up there. I mean, it feels, even though in the modern day sense, you feel sort of away from the rest of the world or from the real world.
Which is a good feeling.
Yeah, and it's. I also was really surprised at how few Westerners or how few non-Asians. Most of the tourists that were there were actually the Japanese that were, and a lot of them on sort of like, it was like a pilgrimage to come there.
So then you left there, hopped back on a bus, you went up to Mount Nataiz. Is that the way it's?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's the correct pronunciation either.
Yeah, you pronounced it about as good as I did. And you go up, it's a Nataiz, and then to Lake Chuzinji, which is a fairly large lake, and there's a really beautiful waterfall there. And fortunately, we hit up there just at the end of the cherry blossom season. In Tokyo, it had already, in Kyoto, it already kind of passed, because we were there at the right middle of May. And I think end of April, 1st of May is sort of the peak. But up in the mountains, you still had the cherry blossoms in profusion, and as we went up to the park, which was up higher up on the mountain, there were even more cherry blossoms to see.
And cherry blossoms are beautiful everywhere. I love cherry blossoms.
Yes.
And then you returned to Nikko, and you decided to do one last thing. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a kind of a sacred, what they think is a sacred bridge that bridges the river there in Nikko. It's the Daya River, and this is it's a beautiful arching red painted bridge that you kind of walk over, and you can go. You kind of come from the temple area, and you walk over this bridge, and you end up at the kind of the head of the main street that goes down into the town. And so we went over the bridge and into town and ate there in a restaurant there in town. And by the time we got through that and shot looking at a few shops, it was time to get back on the train, and we were back in Tokyo by about 8 that evening.
Bill, great trip. Bill Neely, we thank you for this. Now, we understand you're off to Costa Rica here shortly.
Yes, that's right. We're fortunate to get to take off and spend about 8 days down there here this time of year. So we're going to go down there, and then hopefully we'll be back next weekend.
Well, we look forward to hearing, hopefully, a report on that one.
We sure will.
Bill, thank you very much, and we appreciate you taking the time and joining us and sharing this great story with us.
Well, we sure thank you for having us on your show.
It's always a pleasure.
All right.